In this digital age, sometimes it's hard to know what we really own and what we don't. In the new book, Mine, How the Hidden Rules of Ownership Control Our Lives, authors Michael Heller and James Salzman blow out of the water everything we thought we knew about who owns what. Heller is a professor of real estate law at Columbia Law School. He says simple questions such as who controls the space behind your airplane seat can become very difficult to resolve. Heller says six simple stories that we learned in childhood tend to govern most ownership disputes.
We learn about what ownership means from our earliest days. It's one of the absolutely first words that kids learn. They learn to say mine, mine, mine. But when they're saying mine, like when I have two kids and I used to take them to the playground when they were little, and they would be fighting over a toy shovel. And they'd both be saying mine, but they'd be saying it for different reasons. Like my daughter would be saying, mine, I'm holding on to it. And my son would be saying, well, no, it's mine. I had it first. And what it turns out is what they were in that little interaction, they were using two of just the six simple stories that everyone uses to claim everything. So my daughter was saying, I'm holding on to it. Possession is 9/10 of the law. It's one of our basic sayings. And my son was saying first in time, first come, first served, which is another one of the six basic stories. And, you know, grownups use the exact same stories, businesses, governments. There are only those six stories, and we all use them to claim everything in the world.
This Christmas, right before Christmas, we went to the store and there was a really cute little tree. And I said, oh, let's get that tree. And right in front of us came someone who bought two of them. I'm going to put them in my entryway. They were gone. I felt like it was mine. It wasn't mine.
If someone takes the stuff out of your cart, it's like super upsetting. Or you know, one issue that comes up today is with COVID spacing at the beach. Like you put your blanket down, you say, that's my space. And we always know like nobody would sit on your blanket. Like that'd be super weird. But what if somebody sits like within your circle of space? Some people don't mind it, but some people do. It feels kind of like an invasion of space. So possession is a very primitive story. It's actually a language that we all speak. We learn it as kids, and we rely on it as adults to get through our day.
You talk about, not just in this book, but in your earlier book, Gridlock, you talk about different ways of owning space. You talk about the proverbial being in the plane seat and the, yeah, the rights, the knee rights of the person behind and the rights of the person in front to recline in this battle over that. I thought was really interesting.
Well, this is why I love the subject of ownership. It's like you feel like it's like, what is this? How does this matter for my life? But like when you fly on an airplane, like, I don't know if you've had this experience. I always, you know, we professors always fly economy. Maybe you radio hosts fly fancier. But anyway, I'm always stuck in economy and I'm trying to get work done on my computer. And someone, you know, presses the button on their seat in front of me and they lean back basically into my lap. And I'm always, that's actually what motivated the book, is trying to figure out like, whose space is that? The person in front says, well, the button is attached to my seat. So that's the wedge of space behind is attached to my seat and therefore it's mine. That's actually another one of the six basic stories. It's mine because it's attached to something mine. That's the idea that my home is my castle, right? You have a sheet of paper, but what's attached to it? The space up, the space down, the resources, the oil, the gas, the air. The person behind says, me with my computer, I say, no, I possess that space. Just like the kid, possession is 9/10 of the law. Or first come, first serve. I was using that space for my computer first. It's mine. So that airplane wedge battle is the exact same battle that homeowners have for whether they can frack their oil, frack the gas, or whether a drone can fly over your space above. It's really the exact same stories of ownership. What people don't realize, what I didn't realize until I looked into it about the airplane seats, is that conflict over whether you can lean back or not, do you have a right to recline or a right to knee defense? That's actually a conflict that was engineered by the airlines for their profit. So what they realize, and this is true for me, I'm sure it's true for you, is you're sort of, when you're on a plane, you're just trying to be polite. Like you're trying to like get along with the people around you. So, and what airlines count on is you not knowing what the rule is for whether you can lean back or not. When I poll an audience about this question, half of the audience says, yeah, I have the right to recline. And the other half says, no, you don't. I have the right to knee defense. And everyone gets really mad at each other. And the airlines count on that. They count on us getting mad, being polite, viewing this as our personal problem. But the reason that this is a problem is that they've squeezed us together. Like, there used to be enough space between seats. They squeezed us together because they can sell more seats on the plane that way. And they've made that wedge of space super valuable. And what they do is they sell that wedge twice on every flight, on every seat. They sell it for you to recline and for me from my knees. And they count on us to use politeness to sort it out. This is actually one of the most advanced tools of ownership design. We call this strategic ambiguity. And ownership is ambiguous way more often than people realize. And savvy businesses use that ambiguity for their profit. So that's what's going on actually in the airplane seats.
It's just interesting because of COVID, you know, this past year, the concept of space has become so important to people, their space. My space is not your space. And the planes couldn't run. A lot of them went into deep financial holes because of the way they set up their space, because you couldn't get on there, frankly, without being right next to somebody and sharing germs.
Sure. So, you know, it has always been all that airlines have to sell are those inches of space, you know, and that sort of jostling isn't just in the recline seat. It's also jostling for armrests. Like, you all know that, like, that those fights over the armrest and the window shade up or down has become a big fight these days, the overhead bin space. So every inch of space is contested. And during the COVID times, those contests have become even more intense when people feel that an inch of space more or less has real health consequences for them. So this is true not just on airplanes, it's true in parks, it's true on the beach, it's true in restaurants. We've had a real shift in people's awareness of, it isn't a different ownership story, it's still possession is 9/10 of the law, but the importance of it, the salience of it for people has really shifted. I actually have a practical tip for your listeners, which is on the airplane seat, if you don't want somebody to lean into your lap, it turns out if you offer to pay them $20, people get offended. And if you just say, like, you know, don't lean into my lap, people also won't listen to you. But it turns out that 3/4 of the time, if you offer to buy them a drink or a snack, they'll take it and they won't lean back into you. So it actually turns, because then you feel like you're in a community with a person in front of you and behind you. So the airlines create this dilemma, but you as an individual can solve it. And the solution is to basically make nice by buying a drink or a snack for the person in front of you.
You've also written about things like barbed wire and how that segregated space and the Great Plains. I thought that was really interesting because of the effects of that on ranchers versus farmers versus, you know, people who needed to take things across the land.
When you think about, like, the old cattle drives, those movies with the cattle moving across the plains, that was actually a pretty short period in American history. And that was a period when what the cowboy said is basically first come, first served. This may be your land, but, you know, cowboys didn't care about no trespassing signs, and cattle couldn't read them. So they just had these huge herds moving to market. So the effect of barbed wire, which was revolutionary in America, like the current understanding of what ownership means in this country, America is a sort of no trespassing country now, but that notion didn't exist. Actually, when America was founded, you were perfectly free to hunt over your neighbor's land. You didn't have to get their permission. It wasn't trespassing. If the land wasn't fenced, if it wasn't cultivated, the basic rule in America up until quite recently was the right to roam over your neighbor's land. Protein was so important that people were allowed to hunt and collect wild plants over their neighbor's lands without permission. There was nothing wrong with that. That was just your basic right. But what barbed wire did is it changed that quite substantially. So barbed wire was a cheap and easy way to exclude outsiders. It was a cheap and easy way to attach the crossing rights to your land. It's the same as the button on the airplane. So barbed wire sort of works to attach those resources to land, to basically keep out strangers. It made the notion of my home is my castle, the attachment principle, more real for land in America. And just in less than a generation, it changed the Great Plains from a sort of ranching more to a farming set of economies. It was really radical. And the same thing's happening today. So that was true in the 1800s. The same fight over space on an airplane wedge today is the same fight that we have over whether Facebook, for example, can track all the places you go online. what you like and what you look like. Whenever, like, if I like buy a plane ticket to go to Chicago for the weekend, like anywhere else I go on the internet for the next week, every site I go to is going to be sending me ads for Chicago hotels and restaurants. That's because what powers the internet, the reason a lot of internet resources are free to you, is that you're actually not the consumer, you're the product. And the product is information about you, which is called your clickstream. That's worth trillions of dollars, the clickstream. It's the core of internet advertising. And what the internet companies are saying is, your data is attached to our apps, just like the button attaches the wedge of space to the seat. So there is a way to fight back, but it means having a different ownership story. It comes from my body, self-ownership, or I had it first. So part of what we hope for in people sort of thinking about ownership in a more sort of everyday way is that they see that the same fight over whether you can lean back on an airplane, well, that's how the West was settled.
Would you advise people to be more careful about how they make these choices or understand what they mean?
Yes, very much so. So when you're something that matters to you, like, for example, I'm looking behind you and we're actually talking over Zoom so we can see each other. And you have a room full of records. So no one can take those away from you. Like you, and a lot of your identity is wrapped up in the collection of records that, you know, this is the music that's meaningful to me. When you move to an online world where you're streaming music on Spotify or Pandora, and you have your treasured lists, it feels like your records. As soon as you stop paying the monthly bill, that disappears. To the extent that, you know, how we define ourselves as people, like, I think there's a sort of a spiritual connection or a physical connection, certainly, maybe a spiritual connection, at least I feel that, for the stuff in our lives, for the really important things in our lives, you run a real risk of losing that as you move to an online life. So you need to think about ways to protect some of that, that if it is all just streaming, you can lose it very easily. And you need to, and similarly with your tweets and your Facebook pages, you don't own that content. So to the extent that it's meaningful to you, you need to think about ways to back it up and protect it so that if the service disappears or if you stop paying the bill, you don't lose access to sort of the meaningful content of your own life.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing. Just say in the last 10, 15 years, the whole world in which we live is so different. And you cannot, it's almost hard to remember what it was like before when I would buy DVDs and CDs and radio stations like this one would buy all these classical music CDs, right? It's like, we have to have them all.
Right, it's so important. It's sort of part of your identity as a radio station is the collection of music. And, you know, back in the day when I used to go on dates, you know, part of how you sort of found out about a new person was the books and the records that they kept in their home, like what was meaningful to them. And part of how we know ourselves is through our sense of connection to, like, I love to cook. I have old cookbooks from decades ago from dinner parties, and there's stains on the pages from dinner parties I can remember, like when I made that recipe. And that's actually very meaningful to me. And one of the dangers in the sort of new world of ownership, what my co-author and I call the future of ownership, is that we move to a world where we lose connection to the sort of tangible stuff that really helps define us, who we are very meaningfully as people in families and for ourselves. Like, I don't want to live in a world where I lease my dog or I rent my engagement ring.
That was Michael Heller, a professor of real estate law at Columbia Law School. He's one of the authors of the new book, Mine, How the Hidden Rules of Ownership Control Our Lives. His co-author is James Salzman, a professor of environmental law with appointments at the UCLA School of Law and the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management at the University of California, Santa Barbara.